Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcast. You'll be glad you did.
What role does the pandemic play in maybe instituting a market-based raise in the minimum wage? Walter Dublange joins us, our associate professor of economics and finance at my alma mater, UNO, and our friend. Good morning, Dub. How you doing?
Hey, good morning, Tommy. Good to be with you.
Thanks for taking the time with us. So when it comes to, I guess, people finding new careers and moving on, as it relates to the restaurant industry, does that mean it's going to be harder to find people that are going to want to do the work? And if that's the case, is it going to be a market-based raise to the minimum wage somehow?
Well, I think so, yes. Now, I do want to say that this is actually part of a bigger labor change that we're seeing. It seems like the pandemic has given lots and lots of people a year and a half of working from home and doing other type of things to kind of rethink their whole work-life balance. And it's not just the restaurants. This is the, you know, the topic for today. But we're seeing this across the board of people that have been working virtually. They don't want to come back to work. They're wanting people to start their own businesses. We're just seeing a major shift in the whole labor market in the United States. But as regards to the restaurants, you know, I think part of this is, well, of course, part of it is the fact that a lot of these people have been making more money not working than they did when they were working, and some of them actually have saved up and thinking have given them time to think about doing a different career. But yes, in terms of basically market-based economists, I think that the minimum wage becomes irrelevant if if the people can't get workers, then they're going to have to raise the wage, and I think change working conditions. As well as, you know, they mentioned the people yelling and all stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
If you have lots of low wage workers who just can't do any better, then they kind of put up with it. But you know, I think that if that market, and I think that market's not gone yet, but I think there's going to be some demand in general. The minimum wage only applies when the market wage is below the minimum wage. You know, I just saw ads at the, fast food restaurants for starting wages of $10 an hour. Well, $7.25 is meaningless when they're paying $10 starting wages. So I think the minimum, the $7.25 minimum wages has really become irrelevant. It's already irrelevant in, you know, high San Francisco and New York or something like that. But I think it may become irrelevant nationally because precisely what you're talking about. The market's going to drive up not only wages, but I think also working conditions.
I should have put minimum wage in quotation marks because I guess it works a whole lot better when the market determines what does this say, Dub? Let me ask it this way, about the consideration of raising minimum wage, et cetera, and as opposed to leaving the market settle it and where the salary should be.
Well, again, the arguments for minimum wage is, if you have a surplus of untrained workers, you know, lots of workers looking for these jobs and not as many jobs, that will drive the market wage down to a very low level. And the minimum wage concept is to say, well, no, somebody needs, you know, they've been using the phrase living wage. You know, somebody that's working full time ought to be able to at least, you know, pay some type of a minimal level of housing and food, stuff like that. And that, you know, you may not be able to do that at $7.25 an hour. Mm-hmm. And so that's the idea of a socially set minimum wage, is trying to help people that are working full time at least have some minimum level of living. Now, you know, my problem with that is we need to distinguish between all minimum wage workers and say teenagers, where, you know, teenagers obviously are living at home. They don't really, this is extra money for them. And sometimes going out and working and getting some work experience is worth as much as the money that they get out of it. And maybe you need a different wage for teenagers than you do for others. You know, there's several things to be looked at in terms of what's the proper economic policy.
So as far as market forces with the current situation and teenagers and so forth, I guess it wouldn't matter if they're teenagers or not, if the employers are desperate enough to get people to work?
Yeah, I mean, if the market wage is above the minimum wage, then none of this matters. But right. If you're setting a minimum wage above what the market wage is, you know, I would argue that maybe you need to have a two-tier minimum wage. If you want to have one, let's not just put everybody in the same category. But you know, I haven't seen a lot of push to that. That's kind of a – there's an economic argument there, but I don't know that that's found its way into the social psyche yet.
So – and that's what I'm trying to get at, I guess, Dub, is does this – is this kind of like a living – experiment or proof that the market should set wages and not society or a social-based wage?
Well, I mean, the word, my only problem with that is the word should. That becomes a policy decision. From economics, we simply talk about if there's enough demand for workers and the supply doesn't meet that demand at the current wage, then the wages will go up. That's the market-based wages. Okay, and so on the other hand, if you feel that the market-based wage is too low, then that's again, that just becomes a societal decision, not an economic decision. That's when they set a higher minimum wage. And, you know, there have been a lot of talk of raising it to $11, $12, $15. Right now, that's because of the current market. That's not a particularly interesting question because the market's doing it all by itself. But when those extra $300 a month go away at the end of this month, then what's the labor market going to look like at that time? Is the question we got to look at. What's going to be happening in August when all of a sudden, you know, the Louisiana minimum wage goes back to a very, very – basically gets cut in half. Then all of a sudden I think you're going to find a lot more people – those people interested in finding a job.
Let me pick it up there when we come back because I think it's an interesting conversation. And boy, I wish I'd taken more economics at UNO than I did, although – the statistics course, Dubba, you know, it took me four times to get through two of them, so I think I took plenty of that. Money and banking, a different story. Dr. Walter Dub Lane, our guest, Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at UNO. I always get a little nervous when I talk about my college transcript. 9:21 back in a flash here on WWL. 9:26 now, Tommy Tucker, WWL, Thursday morning, July 22nd, talking to Walter Dub Lane, an associate professor of economics and finance at my alma mater, UNO. And, Dub, you know, I said I wished I'd taken more economics, but now that I think about it, it took me a while to get through statistics, and money and banking was a multi-term course, even though it was only one course, so maybe I'm lucky I didn't, and that's why I'm lucky to talk to you.
Tommy, I found that it's very hard to teach economics to 19-year-olds. They have no
maybe that's it
context to do it. I also teach some graduate courses, and I get the same people when they're 25 or 30, and they've, you know, tried to make a mortgage and buy a car and stuff like that. And economics becomes a lot more interesting to them after they've had a little life experiences.
Dub, let me tell you, you just explained it, because when I was at UNO, all I wanted to do, and I started as an accounting major, all I wanted to do was be on the radio. Now that I'm in radio, all I want to do is know about accounting and business. So I guess it does work out that way. What about long-term changes of the economy? Because it's interesting that because of a pandemic and people losing their jobs, they found different jobs. And is it going to result, the pandemic, in a major labor shift in this country in one way or the other?
Oh, I believe so. This is what economists call a structural shift. You know, we have lots of things where you go into recession or expansion or things like this. But I think this long period of change in people's behavior has caused a lot of people to reassess, you know, what they want out of life and things like, you know, I think most people just kind of go to work and they just make it from day to day and day, and they don't really think that much about where they are, or where they're going. But this has given people time to reassess. And they've started, a lot of people have started thinking differently about what they want out of jobs and all this, and that is income the only thing, or is there other things? And that's why I think one thing that's interesting about particularly the issue about restaurants is it wasn't just the money they were complaining about. It was the working conditions, people mm-hmm. screaming all the time. And now some of it you can't do much about, you know, which is they're under pressure to get things out of the kitchen and things of that sort. That's some of that's endemic to the situation. But, you know, my question is, like, rude customers, maybe restaurants won't have to, you know, they've always, the customer's always right. Well, the customer's not always right. They should never be allowed to be rude like some people are. And maybe the restaurants will start, you know, not accepting that. And maybe they'll start treating their employees better as people as opposed to just, you know, slave labor or whatever. So I think we might see, and that one's one is not just the market conditions, is if some restaurants start doing that, they'll be able to hire and hang on to workers. Others will have a hard time doing it, and they'll realize, God, they got to change their behavior. That's also market forces at work.
You know, Dub, I've never worked in food, but I've worked in retail, and I can guarantee you the customer is not always right. As a matter of fact, the customer is often downright wrong, illogical, and expect something for free. Usually it's the people that spend the most that expect the least, and the people that spend the least that expect the most. But we're getting off on a tangent here.
Sure.
I am, at least. You know what I find interesting about this? I don't know if this is a sociological conversation or something that an economist would be able to comment on, but it's interesting to me because these opportunities were always there. The thing that was missing was the motivation for people to avail themselves of them. Is that accurate?
I think so. I mean, like I say, what I'm talking about is behavioral changes, which, of course, is outside the economist's purview. Mm-hmm. But again, what we can do is to say, if those things are happening, how will it affect the market? That's where I can contribute.
So after the enhanced unemployment runs out, and for those of you riding it out, you may want to get off your rear end and start looking, because the 31st, next Saturday, is the final day of that. I don't know when the checks would clear, whatever it is, deposits, whatever you get. Are you going to get a better deal now looking for a job than you would perhaps after the 31st when labor begins to flood the market?
Well, I mean, with the amount of time left, I don't think that's going to happen too much. It'll take a little while to get for some of these people back in the market. It's not like on the 1st that, you know, there's going to be a flood of people out there looking for jobs. Maybe there will. It'll be interesting to see. Mm-hmm. But I think it may take a little longer for that transition to occur.
So what about on the consumer side of it? What we're going to wind up paying more. Somebody's going to wind up paying more, right?
And that's absolutely true, is that if, you know, the labor market changes result in higher wages, those will be 100% passed along to the consumers. That's pretty much guaranteed in this type of a market.
Is that part of the inflation that we're seeing or not yet? And the other question I have for you is, how concerned are you about inflation going forward?
Well, again, I think there's two concerns about inflation. There's what we're seeing right now, which is called the short-term inflation, has two driving forces. One is what we call supply-side forces, like the shortages in lumber and computer chips and actually the labor component to it are all driving up the cost. The other is the demand side of a lot of people that have been sitting on, have not been spending money for the last year and a half, have their pockets full, and they're out trying to spend it. All of that is fairly, I think that'll be affect the market for the next 6 months, a year. And then all of those forces, I think, will even out. So we're going to have some short-term inflation from that, but I'm not worried about that part of it. My concern about inflation is what the government's doing in spending so recklessly with deficits that will cause long-term inflation. But it might be a year or two before that kicks in.
But it would seem to me, and again, keep in mind, I'm, you know, a radio guy, not an economist, but that if the government starts handing out more money, and I'm thinking forward, maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, Dub, with variant and so forth, that would just pour fire on an inflationary fire, would it not?
Yes, absolutely.
I hope they don't do that.
I mean, that's why. You know, some of these things like the infrastructure bill, which we actually, at least parts of that, we desperately need. Mm-hmm. But again, we're already at a case. I said that the what we've seen is that people have been saving, people that have had jobs have been saving a whole lot of money over the last year and a half, and they're flooding the market with private money. The labor market hasn't caught up with that yet. There are other shortages. If you start dumping a lot more government enhanced spending on that, then that becomes even more inflationary. So it's a really difficult right now time for what is the right policy, because I think there's some more spending that's needed. And I think the huge amounts of deficits they did over the last year and a half, a lot of that probably was needed. But we're in different conditions now.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to the CEO of the Louisiana Association of General Contractors earlier, and he was talking about the construction industry in Louisiana losing over 20,000 jobs, and how they are, in a lot of times, high-paying jobs, and the money turns over six and seven times. A couple of different questions. Is there a difference in terms of economic effect of what sector that people are working in, or does the money turn over in the economy pretty much the same way?
There are some sectoral differences, but I don't know that that's the biggest thing. The key idea is if you give money to people who spend it. So that's why, for instance, money that goes to middle and low wage workers, a lot greater percentage of that gets spent. People, uh-huh. Money that goes to high wage workers, a lot greater percentage of that gets saved, and therefore the multiplier effects are smaller.
And I don't know if you can look at it as a return on investment or not, but is it worth it to the economy to add on to the deficit or debt if you're to fund infrastructure, and will the money turn over in the economy to a point where if they could control the spending side of it, it would be a wise thing to do?
Well, and the answer is yes. I mean, the return on investment is exactly the right idea. Economists have a much bigger concern about spending on what's called the current budget than the capital budget. So the infrastructure is what's called the capital budget. And it's mm-hmm. and it's not always a fair comparison to compare the government finances to your home finances. But in this case, it actually is. If you're borrowing money to buy a car or a house that will last for 5 years or 30 years or whatever, then borrowing makes sense. If you're borrowing money to finance a vacation, that's not a good idea. And so the difference is what's called the capital budget and the current budget. So government borrowing to fund infrastructure, I think, has a much bigger justification than government borrowing to simply run the welfare programs or even lots of other types of spending. And so economists do consider, though, in fact, we wish we could separate the budgets, the federal budget into the capital budget and the current budget, which is not done right now. But economists would definitely advocate that.
And one more quick thing before I let you go. Are you concerned, as you hear about COVID variants and so forth, and that the Biden administration will be tempted to issue some more lagniappe, for want of a better phrase?
Yeah, I don't know about that. I haven't thought through that yet in terms of I think there's the point is their spending plans are already so enormous. I don't know that they can really add anything more to it. So
pretty much blown a budget already, literally blown a budget. Thank you, Dub. I appreciate your time as always. Hope you have a good weekend.
Okay. Thank you.
You bet. Walter Dub Lane, Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at my alma mater, UNO. When we come back, we're going to talk to Chris Franklin, our friend, WWL-TV Chief Meteorologist, about how rainy it has been, and is this an anomaly? Is this the new normal? Etc. 9:37 now, 23 before 10. Let's look at traffic on WWL.
Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.